Log Talk Radio.
To the Kay Thompson Live Show. I am the son, also known as Eric Payne. I'm trying to figure out my microphone situation here. Having a couple of problems. And here at the Kay Thompson Live Show with my mom, Kay Thompson. Let me just get this thing straight here while I'm talking to you guys. It's the end of the year show. Last show, 2016. And let's see, like that there.
Yep, everything's straight here.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, what's going on? What's going on? Kind of getting pretty lonely this just a little bit.
Just talk.
Okay. What's going on? Really cold outside, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's changed since yesterday. Yesterday was, you know, fairly, really nice. You know, what guess who I was talking to earlier? First of all, we're going to be having on Anthony Joyner. You know, from Atlanta, he came in town, and we're going to be finding out all about him. He is the son of my sister, Pat Joyner, and we're delighted to be talking to him about what he's doing and the situation there in Atlanta. I want to find out about the school system and several other things if he's going to be talking about that. Also, I'm talking to Larry Hazard tonight, you know, the boxing commissioner. You know, you remember when he was reinstated as that boxing commissioner for the state of New Jersey. And so I happened to call him because I wanted to, you know, him to fill us up to date on what's going on. And, you know, I was following boxing there for a while, and I was hanging Larry on for a little while and every now and then. And it was really great because he had so much information and so much to talk about. So Larry Hazard, boxing commissioner of the state of New Jersey, is coming on Kay Thompson Live next week. I didn't want to, but I wanted to make sure that people know that because he's got a lot to talk about. I'm so tickled because I cannot take the president of the United States seriously. I don't know if it's going to be a dastardly thing that this country is going to be going through. I'm just not sure. Although he was, you know, Donald Trump was making nice with President Obama, I heard on the air, you know, and, you know, Obama was willing to sit down and talk. I don't know if they trust each other or if Obama trusts him. But anyway, President Obama did say that if he had another term. He said he would really get to give him a run for his money. He thought maybe he could beat Trump if he was going to be doing another term of office or something. So what do you think?
I think based on what you're just talking about, that particular thing, he was talking about that if he had to run again on a lot of the platform, for lack of a better term, and the program that he was running on, that he felt he could probably beat Donald Trump, and he probably could. I believe he would, actually, no doubt.
Sure.
Because first, the Obama organization machine is a little bit better than the Clinton, I think. Obviously, he got elected, reelected. So I think, obviously, all of us in reality know that the president would definitely beat Donald Trump in a matchup election, head-to-head. Maybe they'll make an amendment to the Constitution just for this one time, so they have like a grudge match between the president and Donald Trump running against each other. That would be funny. But anyway, it's the end of the year. A lot of things happened. People passed away. Singer George Michael just passed away. Carrie Fisher, Star Wars. Princess Leia, wow.
Yeah.
One of the biggest movie franchises of all time. And who else? The number of people, 2016 has been an interesting year for people passing away, I guess, lack of a better way to put that. But 2016, you know, like any other year, sees its milestones. So it seems like maybe more milestones than not in terms of people who passed away. But, you know, famous people pass away all the time just like regular people. So we just notice the famous ones because they're famous, but mm-hmm. People pass away all the time. Donald Trump and the president going back and forth, Donald Trump not knowing how, he doesn't follow any kind of decorum or any type of standard operating procedure of how presidencies and stuff like that have been done. I mean, you know, usually president-elects don't comment on what the current president is doing, but Donald Trump doing whatever he wants to do has been commenting and, you know, talking trash, not only about the fact of whether Barack Obama could beat him in an election, but also the fact that what's going on with Israel and other things, just backseat driving, really, not waiting until the current president term is up. So it's going to be a bumpy ride with the Trump character, filling his cabinet with all billionaires and people like that. It should be interesting to see if they could really identify with the common working person who so adamantly and enthusiastically supported Donald Trump. Hopefully he'll live up to those campaign promises. We already heard him in some speeches at rallies recently talk about, you know, what he said, certain things, some phrase, I forget the phrase in particular, but he said, you know, it caught on, so he kept saying it. He didn't like it initially. So that means what? He didn't really believe in what he was saying. So he was just basically saying what he had to say to get elected, I guess. And he's admitted as much in certain follow-up rallies and things like that, victory thank you tours or whatever you want to call them. And, you know, the guy consistently contradicts himself, you know.
He's a
hypocrite. Yeah, he's like a comedian. Mm-hmm. But, and he tries to making up your own news, I guess he's effectively make up, that's just part of the narrative, the lies that someone keeps telling. But you have to give it to Donald Trump. He's used the Twitter geniusly, turned it into an art form to get his own personal platform out. You know, the whole hope of the internet and technology, I think the hope of technology, just the term technology, is that we all use technology to improve our minds, to get more intelligent, more educated. That's I'm sure whenever people develop technology and work in the technological fields, hope that with their technology, it can improve our knowledge, man's knowledge. Mm-hmm. So, there should be no reason why people are making ill-informed decisions. It's like the more educated one gets, the more aware you hope one becomes, the more enlightened. So as the world gets older and older and people get more educated about life and about the world, you know, old beliefs and norms die off, like the world being flat or this or that, you know, these things, like people being prejudiced, not liking people for one skin color or not. You would think that technology has helped those people to get enlightened to the fact to realize that that perspective is ignorant. That's what you hope that technology does, helps to enlighten and educate people so they don't think the same ignorant things that they thought at one time once they get educated, once their eyes are open, or like the people around the hood say, once they get woke, you're not supposed to believe the same old idiotic stuff unless you're just someone who wants to cling to that. And there's a certain faction of the Trump supporters that are those people, certain faction of Trump supporters that are racist and the varying degrees of people who make their decisions based along racial lines and ethnicity and nationality. And, you know, there's varying degrees of racism and prejudice and stuff like that. You know, might get the racist who actively wants to keep people of color down and wants to jump on them, beat them, kill them, annihilate them. That's, you know, terrorist racist. It might be the racist who just doesn't like people of color and not going to have nothing to do with them, or if they can screw them, they would, or mess with them. Then you have varying degrees of people who just don't want to be around other people. So it's all varying degrees, but the rallying cry, when it's you, that you can identify all of these various sectors, is that how the person that they're attracted to, the person that they support, comes out. Like Donald Trump's first statements, first political statements, pretty much were, you know, all Mexicans are rapists and murderers, and I suppose some of them are nice people. So that was your first statement, and that rallied all of these people, were drawn to you because of that being one of your first statements. That tells you, you know, pretty much where they stand from a racial perspective, and it's kind of a, like I said, an antiquated, unintelligent perspective if you write off an entire group of people based on your preconceived notions or notions told to you by other people, because, you know, when you get out in the world and travel the world, you find that the world could really be a beautiful place when people all come together and you meet people from various different ethnicities, different people from all over the world. It could really be a fantastic place, but you have to be educated and exposed to those things, two different types of people. You know, those people who go on those exchange programs, and, you know, people go on exchange programs to high school or do the Peace Corps or whatever. There's a certain perspective that they return home with, a worldly perspective about people all over the world. So, you know, you hope that technology, people don't have to travel the world. Maybe they can travel the world through the technology that they have, unless you're just the type of person who wants to hear somebody saying the type of stuff you want them to want to hear, and you don't want to hear anything different. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the problem why this America is so polarized. Obviously, people lost their mind when a black man was elected president, to the point of that there was a guy that was siding with the other side, a foreign entity against our country, encouraging, as Trump did, encouraging them to hack more into Hillary Clinton's emails and things like that, encouraging them to commit espionage, basically cyber espionage, but espionage against a citizen of the United States. And that was still okay with a lot of his, with all of his supporters. That was still okay. You have him siding with the country that, if you're somewhere in your 50s or older, has always been identified as United States' arch rival, our enemy, Russia. Always been that way. And you have this guy siding with their head of state over the current president of his own side, of his own home country. So the racism runs so deep that they're willing not even to be patriotic and get behind their American own, but get behind a guy who was supported by a foreign entity, an arch rival, no less, as and stand with him against the American president. Stand like the whole situation with Israel today, the prime minister, which has been an ongoing thing. But it's the same thing that the Senate and the Congress invited Netanyahu to come and speak, joint session of Congress. You know, it is the disrespect that has been shown to this president because of his race. But, I mean, we know just how far extreme that so many people, how mad they were by electing someone who spouts that kind of racism. Let me see your birth certificate and all that, calling Obama, all these kind of things. So it was really an eye-opener for me in my lifetime, just really what that there are no rules, A, because this guy broke all of the rules, and people were still willing to go with that because they wanted their, I don't know, because of their prejudice, their hatred, because they wanted their one of their own kind there who was clearly so unprepared, but also using divisive tactics to get elected, pitting Americans against Americans and kind of demagoguing people. Mm-hmm. So and that was okay with people, even though obviously you can see this guy has obviously lied several times, changed his mind and all that, but still that was okay. People say, tell them like it is. He tells it like it is. Telling it like it is, and politically correct is trying to be polite sometimes. But people, they don't want politeness. They don't want to know that America, the whole facade and myth of America, conquering, coming to the new world and trying to settle, there's a lot of that is a myth and a facade. The people that were indigenous to this land were murdered off. And then a myth and a story and a fairy tale was made about people conquering the Old West against these savage, evil people that were trying to kill them. It was just the other way around. So, you know, let's stop being politically correct. Let's stop being and tell it like it is. People really want to tell it like it is. But here's the thing. There's some people who can't take it. Their heads explode when you tell it like it is, when you tell them the truth. And they don't want to accept the truth anyway. But it should be a bumpy ride. It should be a real bumpy ride. We got a guy that's head of the Energy Commission or Energy Agency that couldn't name that agency 2 years, the first time he ran for president. We got a guy that's going to be head of an agency who said he had no experience and no qualifications to be head of an agency. And we got a guy who wants to dismantle an agency that's head of that agency. You can't make it up, everybody. You can't make this type of stuff up. Y'all thought the House of Cards and all that other stuff was too wild for to really happen? Shoot, man. Donald Trump is going to show us some whole new thing.
Yeah.
God bless him.
Oh, boy. I don't know.
Do you have anything to say?
Yeah, I have some things I want to say. As a matter of fact, you know, I did this, I think I might have done this last week or the week before, but I've had a few requests to do it again because people didn't hear it. And this was a, excuse me, this is a letter from POTUS, from the President of the United States. It's on the White House stationery. The White House, Washington, and it's from President Obama, and it was sent to my cousin, Elizabeth Van Oy, Newark, New Jersey, because she had written, you know, Obama to tell him about, you know, our family, you know, her family really on her father's side, you know, about what was happening with him a long time ago, and this is, I'm going to read it anyway. It says, Dear Elizabeth, now this is from President Obama to Elizabeth or Peggy Van Oy. Thank you for the letter you sent me about your family. I was struck by the pictures and the articles that you shared, and it's clear that you're carrying on your family's remarkable legacy through your own service to your community and to our country. Your uncle and grandfather fought on different sides of the Atlantic for the same noble cause, to extend the reach of liberty's life. Despite being denied rights by the country, they risked their lives to defend. They overcame forces of oppression and division and were both part of an unbroken line of patriots dedicated to upholding the ideals for which they knew to be true and just. It seems like your grandfather and uncle were remarkable men, both in and out of uniform, and I am humbled by their legacy of service. Please tell your sister I said hello. I wish you both the very best. Peggy or Elizabeth. Her sister is Sally Carroll, who was the first African-American policewoman in New Jersey with the Newark Police Department. And so that's who this comes from. And at the bottom of the page, you know, Peggy wrote, a note to me, Kay, please talk about this. So here, and she writes the note, says, here's, you know, I'm not saying too well because the light is not the brightest. Here is a copy of my letter from our POTUS, she says. Since I received this, I'm so proud. What's more, my mom's side of the family, Sally, and there are last surviving immediate dependents, and her last surviving immediate dependents, descendants, right, of overextended, something I can't really see that, on my mom, her mother's side of the family. The story is now in the Library of Congress archives being processed, and she wanted to, and she worked hard to make this happen. It wasn't written too clearly, by the way, but, and she said, please show this to Congressman Donald Payne also. So this is a letter from the president. And it was dated January 19th, 2016. So that's the end, I guess, the end of his term or something. Because
no,
I guess all the letters.
It was a year ago, January 19th, 2016.
Yeah, okay. So, yes. So, anyways, and she was very proud of this letter, and she gave me a copy, and she wrote that, you know, note to me at the bottom of the letter.
She wrote him to tell him about what her father.
About, you know, her grandfather.
Her father was.
Yeah, were. Both fought in the, you know, the early, you know, wars. But one was on one side, apparently, and one was on the other side. Okay?
Or maybe.
He says. It seems like your grandfather and uncle were remarkable men, both in and out of the uniform, and I am humbled by their legacy of service. Please tell us who stretched that hill out.
Okay.
You know? But earlier it says that your uncle and grandfather fought on different sides of the Atlantic for the same noble cause, to extend the reach of liberty's light. You say?
So I don't think they fought on opposite sides.
No, but, you know.
They fought from different places.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So finally, and she worked on it for a long period of time, and she had not.
To let him know
that, you know.
So they could get in the Library of Congress.
Yes, I would imagine that, yeah. And then she asked that we kind of show it to Congressman Donald Payne, and if you will take that and show that to him, then I can, I'll have it framed or something, because this is a copy of that which she sent, and she's quite proud of it. So to know that the President of the United States took his busy schedule, you know, and put it aside for, you know, a minute or two to actually respond. So I wanted Terry her to know that. So that's a good thing today. And let me see, what else? Well, that's what we're talking about, Trump. I'm at the point where I am, Donald Trump absolutely amuses me. You know, I mean, at this particular point, it's like a big game, a funny game. And every time he says something, you want to say, what the heck is he doing? And then with his twittering at night, that's the kind of stuff that kids do. It's unheard of. And it has no dignity to it. And apparently he wakes up early in the morning and he twits or whatever he's doing. He twits or tweets or whoever cares what the word is, but he does it.
Yeah.
Tweet away.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be an interesting presidency with Donald Trump and all of the other day, I guess yesterday, Trump Tower, they had to clear everybody out and evacuate because they had a backpack that somebody left and they got all nervous, turned out to be some toys or something like that. But, the new president coming in, obviously he can't wait to get there because he keeps interfering with what the current president is still doing. But it's interesting. Hopefully we can work to make Donald Trump a one-term president, if not sooner. And I think that Democrats and progressives or people who want him out should, I'm sure many have already started already, but we should start ASAP. Just like all of those Congress and senators, congressmen and senators did when they plotted to make sure that Barack Obama didn't have any victories at all during his time in the White House. And I think progressive liberals and Democrats need to be on the same mission as well to get rid of Donald Trump, to take over the House of Representatives and the Senate, and as well as state legislatures across the country. I mean, we could do that. If we get organized as Democrats. But that's the only way that we're really going to win and change the direction of this country. You know, because not only are we fighting against people who are pretty well organized and motivated, but also a lot of them have displayed a willingness to cheat, basically, and make stuff up. So and that's already been proven over and over again. And but if you just look at some of the tactics they use or some of the laws that they try to enact, making voting rights harder for a lot of Americans, cutting back on one's ability to vote, coming up with all these little kind of nitpicky laws to trip people up. You know, when people try to play by the rules and people that make up the rules and they make up really complicated, specific rules aimed at a specific group of people, it's obvious, even though you're using the legal process, even though you're using the vote and all that, it's still obvious that what you're doing is morally corrupt and morally incorrect and morally evil. No matter how many technicalities that people use, no matter how many little tricks within the laws and within the rules you use, your intent, your overall objective is still of evil purposes, is to keep people back, to keep people down, to oppress people. So that's what we have to be careful about getting caught up in, the little technicality. It's just like the whole notion that the moderators for the debates in the presidency shouldn't be fact checkers, because Donald Trump told so many lies that I guess they came up with the idea that you would spend so much time correcting his lie you would never get through the debate. But still and yet, that's the crux of the issue, isn't it? If this guy's telling so many lies, we can't even get through the debate because you keep lying and we keep out the fact checking you. Shouldn't that tell you something about the dude running for president? As opposed to just saying, let's not be fact checkers. Then what are we talking about then? We're just sitting up here letting two people talk. That was the most idiotic thing I ever heard. But hey, you know, there's kind of, you can tell when society or the press or whatever, or the, you know, people get the message, they get the memo, and all of a sudden certain questions aren't answered, or maybe certain people aren't thinking about certain questions. But that seemed to me to be a pretty big one. Oh, you don't want the moderator to be a fact checker in the course of a debate? Wow. Okay. This constant hypocrisy within this this year's presidential election that has been confounding and dumbfounding to me. You know, the level of racism that's still alive in this country, and the obvious depths to which people are willing to go to achieve those means. It's really like some stuff out of one of those old movies, you know, where people were the evil office holders and people that wanted to keep people's rights down and oppress people, and they did whatever diabolical means. It's kind of like It's a Wonderful Life, you know, with Mr. Potter, the evil rich baron who was in the town of I forget the name of the place where they lived, but in the town that George Bailey and everybody lived. And everybody had to come through this guy, and George Bailey and his father there, and their building and loan association representing the people and an advocate for the people. And Potter was trying all over everything. He was the rich, evil, rich guy, you know? It's like that, you know, where we're almost seems like we're up against those times again, where if you try to speak out, you know, the guy tries to crush you. Like the current president-elect comes out and tweets people to death and dogs people out and makes up lies and just makes stuff up. So the lengths that which some people have been willing to go have really, that's been the astonishing thing. But like I said, it's almost like a movie or something like that. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. I want to get back to the subject of, you know, Glenda Taylor's book. I've referred to it before, and the one that I've always been very impressed with, and there's so much information in this book, and every now and then I give out a little bit more, and the name of her book, of course, is, and I say of course because I've talked about it before, is The Jalamuso Drum, and it's about African-American female entertainers as cultural historians, griots, if you will. And she talks about famous and sometimes not so famous African-American women who have made quite a dent in our history and who have courageously fought for their rights. And regardless as to what they were going through, amidst all the throes of racism, sexism, persecution, and especially the brutal, she says, the brutal suffocation of life, dignity, and humanity within the black community, the African-American entertainers and celebrities have raised a war against oppression, combating the subjugation, and the marginalization of African-American stories and female entertainers. And she said that they have paved the way, and I want to go over some of these things that I've previously gone over because you can never get enough about finding out who our famous women were who gave up themselves and who became griots, all right, and jalamusos. So for those of you who are listening and you want to get this book by Glenda R. Taylor, Glenda is spelled G-L-E-N-D-A, Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, the name of it is The Jalamuso's Drum. Jalamuso, everybody. That is spelled J-A-L-I-M-U-S-O apostrophe S, drum. Jalamuso's Drum. And if you separate it into syllables, then you can even figure it out. J-A-L-I-M-U-S-O apostrophe S, The Jalamuso's Drum. The Jalamusos are women who have combated oppression and who have also combated subjugation and the marginalization of the African-American story. And these people are entertainers. She took the people from the entertainment field. She says they have consciously and unconsciously used their voices, their art forms, and their autobiographies to preserve their story, which is the African-American story, which is the American story. And it's a story that reflects the beauty that is American in the tradition of the African griot or cultural historians. So a Jalamuso is really a griot. A griot is like a cultural historian, according to Glenda Taylor, who is quite an author and a writer. She has written, I don't know how many different books at this particular point, but she will be coming on in about 2 months, I think. Anyway, in the tradition of the African griot or cultural historian, African-American entertainers or celebrities have laid out their autobiographies with coded and sometimes uncoded messages, words which preserve a fascinating history yet to be totally uncovered, assessed, and analyzed by historians, researchers, and scholars. A lot of people are reusing this book. Every time I go through it, somebody calls me about it and says, what's the name of that book again? Well, the name of the book is The Jala Musa's Drum. Now, it also argues that the African-American female entertainer is a griot, who is a Jala Musa, a griot, a cultural historian who has preserved decades of American history within the pages of her autobiography and creative works. Now, her voice, the African-American female entertainer, is viewed as a magnificent part of history. The Jala Musa Drum proposes that there are a number of women that Goenda mentions and who she considers to be historians, who she considers to be, really people who have made a real important dent, in combating racism and in combating sexism. The talent, now I can't say by just because their talent was enormous. And some of those people are Marian Anderson, Lena Horne, Ruth Brown, Nina Simone, Etta James, Aretha Franklin, and Eartha Kitt, just to name a few. Now, they have not only been entertainers, she says that they have played a major role in civil and human rights movements. A lot of them, have at some time or another, responded to, marches and performing and, doing things to help the community, and especially, dealing with women's rights. And they have recorded American history in their compelling and powerful autobiographies at times. When the scholarship is done on analyzing and interpreting autobiographies as primary historical sources by historians such as Gerda Lerner, Joanne Braxton, Darlene Clark Hine, Alice Kessler Harris, and Lois Bannon. Some of these names I'm not totally and completely familiar with because they are really early on. But also combine them with the voices of Toni Morrison, Nikki Giovanni, Bell Hooker, Jean Noble, Alice Walker, and Paula Giddings. You find that the African-American female's perception of herself and her society is essentially in comprehending the complexity of American history and culture. So, and you realize that, black females, they've taken and they've been given the responsibility as really people who interpret what they're feeling and interpreting, different acts of racism. And these entertainers use their art form there and their biographies and memoirs to record history, okay, especially what they've gone through. And she names a lot of these women, For instance, she's very impressive with Whoopi Goldberg, by the way. And in reading this, I'm going to, I'll let you know as soon as we get to the portion on Whoopi, because Whoopi is extremely bright. She keeps the view, right in the view. So, and she doesn't let anybody get away with, silly nonsense about anything racial on that particular show. So, Glenda Taylor also says that the entertainers and celebrities have always had an influence on public opinion. Their words and images affect the lives of the masses. Their songs and films influence the decisions that people make. If you were to pick out some of the, powerful women entertainers there, you having been, acting, in the field and you've met a number of women, powerful women, do you find this to be, have merit? What about the female entertainers, making a real dent in the lives of entertainers of note and should be recognized as such? And especially, she considers them scholars.
Because I'm sorry, I wasn't in the conversation as well.
In the way that they sing, in the songs that they sing, and then the creative things that they do, and the, if they're writers or something, You know, they tell the story of what black women or black people have gone through in this country. So do you find
there's a particular voice, yeah. If you look at just the show we were watching or the news TV show, one of my favorite shows is Queen Sugar, which is created by Ana DuVernay. I believe that's her name, who also directed the movie Selma, black woman director, a strong advocate of obviously stories being told by black women or just from black perspective. Very strong black female characters in that show that she's created. And she has formed a partnership with Oprah Winfrey on their own network, and they're producing quality television. Of course, people in the entertainment capacity in life and storytellers have always been one that they have a lot of people watching them. They have a big audience, a big platform. So, of course, they always have the potential to affect people and to for people to look up to them. And, you know, that's what some parents want. People try to encourage their children not to look up to movie stars, but the people with substance. But also, a lot of people that are considered movie stars or actors are people of substance, and many are humanitarian, and many are not the stereotypical persons, just self-absorbed and worried about themselves, but are people of the world and have ideas and thoughts about problems that face humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the humanitarians like Angelina Jolie, she does a lot of good work in kind of Africa and helping people all over the world, as do a great many others. So, the entertainers really have a wide reach, and certainly black female entertainers are ones that have told the story and have a unique story and position, obviously, in telling the story of black people in America. I mean, if we look at one such movie, it makes me think about a segue into the movie Offenses. Also, the movie Hidden Figures about, even more so, this current movie Hidden Figures about the black women who were part of the space program that sent John Glenn to be the first human orbiting the planet. It was a black woman that did the math, that did the calculations that made it possible for him to do that. So that is an incredible thing. That's a part of history, black history, that I like to consider myself pretty aware about the historical notes or monuments in our history, but I've never heard of this woman and even this program of the number of young black women in the 60s mm-hmm. that helped to make the space program a success back then.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to go see that movie. And that has some of those very very black women that you were referring mm-hmm. to and that Glenda refers to in that book there can be exhibited or played in that movie Hidden Figures. The other movie I was going to mention is Fences talk about strong female not necessarily role models, because the character of Rue or Rose, I forget the character's name in Fences, that Viola Davis plays, who plays Denzel Washington's character Troy's wife, is a very strong character, and it's one of those powerhouse roles. And Viola Davis, being an actress that has that depth, that has always had that depth and that dramatic range. If you've seen her even in things before she was famous, you can see her bringing the heat. You know, you can't help but deny or notice performances by actors like that that have that strong emotional depth, that strong, serious depth of work that they bring to their work. And Viola Davis is certainly one of those actresses. So I look forward to seeing that and the strong performance that she's putting in with that. So black women throughout, the female entertainers, of course, have been ones that have had a platform where they could talk to their own community and mm-hmm. society in a larger perspective. And maybe the fact that it was coming from a female perspective probably seemed less threatening to the overall population, and also to some of that population more alluring, the beauty of the black woman. You know, some of these white guys were intoxicated by that back in the day, but and still are to this day. But you wanted to say, Ma?
Yeah, that I'm so impressed with the fact that the black female entertainers really told the story of what they were going through. But some of them really, those who went to Europe, you know, and who are performing in Europe, and they came back and made notes and sometimes wrote books, as Glenda says, you know, the perspectives of these entertainers became significant because they realized that they perceive of themselves as cultural historians. They may not have, you know, used those words or being activists at that time, but they certainly were, because some of them were very angry about the way they were treated, not only here in the United States, but when they went to Europe. And some of them also saw that they were treated better in Europe than they were in the United States, and that was because of racism, you know. And also, within the...
You're referring to, just a clarification purpose, you're referring to a certain period of time with the experiences of certain performers in black women at the time. I see Nina Simone, that's names that stand out in the book, Lena Horne, Catherine Dunham, and Diane Carroll. So this would be during their heyday, talking about the 60s and 50s, 60s, maybe even the 70s.
Yeah, a little bit. And it was their heyday, but at the same time, what happened was that those who came back to talk about it and those who had written some books on it and written about it, such as like Catherine Dunham was the dancer. You know, and as a matter of fact, she was. I had one class with her years and years ago, and she was. I don't know if she was located with her studios in New Orleans or someplace. You know, but Nina Simone, Mississippi Goddamn. You know, there's a certain message in that music. I remember when she had her last performance down there at the Symphony Hall, where she sang Mississippi Goddamn. You know, Lena Horne, of course. Diane Carroll and Etta James and other African-American female entertainers, they really had an impact on society, says Glenda. And he is absolutely right. So sometimes they have you know, international fame, you know, that in some sense, some of them say or maintain that they were treated better in Europe than they were, you know, here in the United States. And so what she also has done is she has mentioned a few people who are also authors, like Toni Morrison. And, let me see, I wanted to get to Toni Morrison, storyteller, and Jella Musso's, yes. And I wanted to get to what she was saying about Whoopi Goldberg, because I found that absolutely, absolutely fascinating.
Okay.
I'm finding it.
So, that, the black women at the tennis, that's always been a good thing. Just a couple of things that I wanted to talk about a little bit more is that this riff, going back to a little politics of the day before we move on, and this being the last show of 2016, the next time that we talk will be into 2017, of course, obviously, but also to... it will be about 2 weeks before the Obama leave office as in the United States. And we'll be into the bumpy ride with President-elect Donald Trump. I think it's contingent upon people who are progressives, Democrats, and the like, to make sure that the legacy of Barack Obama is not misstated, misrepresented, lied about, misconstrued, you know, or killed off, which is what they're going to try to do, of course. So it's contingent upon the progressives and Democrats to make sure that legacy, which is a legacy of, I think, pretty much core Democratic values and core just decent people values, is a pretty good one, and one that includes the broadest cross-section of people, one that includes all people. So let's try to exclude anybody as to some of the other things coming from some other people from time to time. Black Lives Matter stepped up and became the premier new civil rights organization, activist organization, young people getting it done, getting involved, getting tired of being sick and tired. So hopefully our game plan can be a little bit different in terms of how we than it has been in the past, in terms of how we can continue our fight against oppression for a lot of people in this country that happen to look like myself and happen to be people of color. So, we can work for that. Also, too, what makes me also kind of happy is the fact that that pipeline was halted up in North Dakota for the time being, at least anyway, and that it's not going to run past this sacred land for this Native American tribe that's up there. One thing I heard about in the news today is that the United States no response about how they're going to respond to Russia being involved in our presidential election. Something kind of goofy to me is that we're kind of announcing our response, you know, like saying America in the news. If you paid attention to the news today, you noticed that the statement coming out of the official in the White House is like America's going to respond to Russia for interfering in our election next week. And I mean, they're just being real specific. Even the fact that they're saying they're going to have some type of repercussions to me is like, why are we telling people what we're going to do? And that's part of that notion, that idea right there, I think is a very kind of, might sound a little bit Trumpity, right? But it's really a common sense thing. Why are you going to tell somebody what you're going to do? You're going to retaliate to them for doing underhanded tactics. And that type of notion is the thing, one of the things I think that got Donald Trump elected, you know, because I'm sure I'm not the only one who said, well, why are we announcing that we're going to have some sort of response to Russia? Why are we pretty much pinpointing when it's going to happen and what type of response it's going to be? Why don't we just do it? And that's the thing that a lot of people, a cross-section of Americans, far right, far left, would think about. And that's something that a Trump or even a Bernie would both bring up that point. If we're going to do something, somebody, let's not announce it. Let's just let them go. So I think that's one of the things that basically, one of those type of things, the things that probably got Donald Trump elected, when they say he was not your typical politician. But also those are the same things that are drawbacks about him, you know, or the things that you don't like about him if you're on the other side, or certainly a Democrat or a liberal person, what he's willing to do or say. So you wanted to say, Mom?
Yeah. You know, I think it was interesting when Obama said in conversation to somebody that he thought that he could probably he would give Trump a run for his money. He might be able to beat Trump if he ran again, you know, if he had another term, you know. And he was serious about it. So that's what he said, and I'm quite sure that he probably could, you know, because of the fact that, you know, you have this person who he's changed a little bit. Because of the fact that he knows, meaning talking about Trump, he's changed because he's finally listening to people, I would imagine, a little bit. But I do think that if Obama were to have another term, okay, I really think he would vote. I mean, he would win again, because what he's done has been for everyone, you know, whereas Trump is doing it for a few, okay, and they just happen to be, the majority of them, of course, are white. The majority of them are wealthy. The majority of them, you don't have many women at all. And he doesn't really take women seriously. So that's dangerous in itself. You should know better.
Right, right. But even in his supporters, they're still are outnumbered by Hillary, those people who actually voted for Hillary Clinton, because of the popular vote. She won by more than 3 million votes. She got 3 million more than he did. It is the Electoral College. That ironically has, I guess not ironically, because that's kind of the way it was designed initially, the Electoral College, to make sure those smaller voices are equal to, you know, it was done initially, I've heard, to appease the southern states after slavery was abolished and to give them some sort of sway over, or at least as much sway as these large populations of people, which would include a large number of ex-slaves. I guess they felt that those ex-slaves didn't deserve the same amount of respect that those fewer slave owners, former slave owners, deserved. And I think that's how the Electoral College came about, giving a state with a population of 10% of one state's population as much say so as in terms of votes and voting power as the largest state with a larger population. It seems to me that democracy is you know, the majority rule. That's kind of what democracy is based on. The most number of people vote for this, and that's how you got to go. But also within a democracy, obviously you don't infringe upon the minority's rights, You just understand that the largest cross-section, largest section of people want to live their society this way. And this is the way that works for the largest cross-section of the most diverse society. So I guess those battles are really hard fought and hard won in a country that was pretty much founded on a supremacist kind of perspective and pretty much founded with the advent and the invention of slavery, of subjugating one human race to another. So it's not surprising to hear that there's people with the notions that one race, their race is superior over another's race. That's how this country has been. It was founded and lived for so many years, and then trying to overcome that sin of America, the stain of our society is racism, that, a whole race of people was held captive for hundreds of years. You know, and America is trying to reconcile, come out of that. And so I guess it takes another couple of hundred years to come out of that. But with that, there are still people who have this superior perspective or think they deserve some sort of superior type of treatment, nothing other than their exterior covering, their skin. So it's kind of weird, but it's been going on, and it seems to be something that we'll continue to have to fight and fight against being oppressed by these people. And if you look at the kind of the police forces all across the country, it's an interesting observation you can make, where you see how militarized they're becoming. You know, when you see these issues of policemen in riot gear, how much really they look like urban soldiers, which they become, and the firepower and all of the weaponry that they have, the technology that they have available to them is really kind of like you would think that they're fighting a foreign enemy, you know, but that just goes to show you maybe they do think that even though these people are citizens of the same country that they're in, they're still a foreign enemy. And until we change that line of thinking, that notion, that perspective by a lot of people, the country is always going to be divided in certain areas. Certain areas of the country is really thriving and people are getting along really well, but other areas of the country, people aren't getting along. And I'm also an advocate of if people don't want to be around people, they don't have to. You don't have to make people be around people. You can't make people, for instance, if someone is a prejudiced person who doesn't want to be around people of a certain type, I think you should make them. I don't think they should be ostracized or ridiculed because they prefer to be around their own kind or a particular type of people. I think the problem occurs when they try to enforce their views on other people. Obviously, that's when the problems always occur. Or when they try to inflict and impede and oppress other people's rights, you know. So our society should be a place where, you know, if those alt-right kind of cats and those type of people all want to live in a society where they have all white people, and they want to have that all-white neighborhood, hey, have at it, you know. Nobody wants to be around people that don't want to be around them. So I say, you know, you can't legislate how people feel inside. But you can legislate is how people interact in public when they come across each other. And you can't have one just because, you know, they might be in a position of power, of authority, that's supposed to serve the entire population or community. Influence, letting those values or those beliefs influence. Say if you have a racist person or someone who believes, Kim Davis is the woman who refused to issue marriage licenses to gay people because she had very strong Christian values. It's a perfect example. But what happened was that she was in a position where she had a government job. She had a job that really superseded, you know, her religious beliefs. It said, the government job said, if your religious belief is going to come in effect how you do your job, then this is not a job for you. That was part of the stipulations of having that job. And so it became that big issue that it came. But the bottom line is that her personal religious beliefs could not come into play within the course of her doing the duties of her job, that particular job. So that's when we get into a sticky area. But if people have beliefs, just like certain sects or communities, you have the Amish, they have their own community, they do this thing, they don't bother nobody, that's cool. You know, America can be that type of place. It shouldn't have to be. you know, people should be willing to interact, or of course should understand that there's a whole another world that's opened when you interact with different types of people from all over the world. But some people don't want to do that, and they shouldn't be made or forced to do that. And that's the whole good thing about America. So that's kind of where I'm coming from with that. You know, also too, the whole issue of the police issue. You know, we have to first, you don't let the bad guys become the cops. You know, the people with these perspectives about a certain group of people. But also too, our first responders, like police officers, all cops, firefighters, all these type of people should be paid a lot more money for what they do, because at any given moment they're called upon. Their job description is put your life on the line. So when you have somebody who's going to protect your society like that, they need to be compensated. But also, individuals, I'm talking about cops now, need to have at least a cop in my world, in Eric's platform. They will be required to have some sort of degree, college degree, associate's degree, or whatever, because what your job entails is something that is really a high level job. Interacting with the public, you got to jump and play hero if you need be. You know, you got to jump into the physical, and so you know, my personal platform would be that police officers deserve more pay, as do firefighters and teachers as well. But also too, you know, we have the issue of if we don't want to have this rift between black people and cops and cops and other peoples, I think it's incumbent upon those particular police officers that know about the bad guys to beat out the bad guys and to reject them. Not saying that that's not done already, but that needs to be encouraged to be done a lot more, a lot sooner. Because, of course, there's within the ranks, there's people that know who are the bad guys, who are the racists, who have certain perspectives. And it kind of just leads to bad things happening if you're concerned about people being shot in the street. But that's just my thing. And hopefully, going forward in 2017, we can curb some of the violence between police and some segments of the population.
Now I want to go back too. I'm going to jump. Going to be jumping. Yes, I'm jumping back to the early Galamusos. In this book by Glenda, she mentions Hattie McDaniel. You know, I was watching Gone with the Wind the other day. I watched it a couple times. Hattie McDaniel was one of the main fourth women in that movie. As dopey as the movie was, it's brilliant. Real brilliant, brilliantly done, and it gives us an idea of what slavery was like, how white women treated black women, et cetera, et cetera. Butterfly McQueen. You mean to tell me that we used up all this? I have a lot more to say about, you know, the Jelly Russos. But anyway, we have about 90 seconds, and, you know, is that the end of the show?
Yeah.
Wow, man.
Yeah.
I like this.
Yeah, our other co-host, Wayne Gilman, was off tonight. He's going to be back with us again next week. We want to let everybody know that we're usually on. We're on every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. That's the live aspect of the show. But the show also is archived, so you can listen to any episode you want, anytime you want. And we want to thank anybody for tuning in, everybody for tuning in. And I am the Sun, also known as Eric Payne, or Citizen Payne on my Facebook thing, and Eric Payne on my Instagram. Check out my acting page and Instagram thing, and you are?
Kay Thompson here, everyone. Join us next week at 8 to 8 o'clock. I'm 8 until 9 for Kay Thompson Live, and we will have more interesting, probably even more information about Galamusos, some and a number of other things. So join us next Wednesday or every Wednesday, 8 to 9 o'clock
We're on blogtalkradio.com/KayThompson. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you too. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.